Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. You're number two, burns the hair in my nose. But we fought hand in paw, now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 23rd of October, 2020. On the podcast today, Bill Brody Good, CEO and Technical Director of Alien Metals, UFO is ticker there, and Bill discusses their earning agreement on their Donovan 2 copper gold project in Mexico. Plus, Paul Hill, full-time investor and equity analyst, gives his view on the market, and we mention the following companies: Lloyds, HSBC, Equals, On The Market, Polarian, GSK, and Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about transport stocks and their significance on the wider economy. Plus, at the end of the podcast, I have two lists for you. Top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll also see lots of other content. Right there, check it out. There, articles, videos, podcasts. In fact, Paul there is on a video of a must-watch, a Vox exclusive Capital Market Summit. And you've got some big names there. Martin Gilbert, who else there? Chris Watlin, Justin Urquhart-Stewart, and David Buick. And as always, of course, at the top of the page at voxmarkets.co.uk, you'll see the COVID-19 index. And biggest rise of days, 4D Farm up 13.2% to 130. Biggest faller, Gene Drive, down 4.3% to 105, or 1.5. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Bill Brody Good, CEO and Technical Director of Alien Metals. The ticker there is UFO. Bill, good to chat to you.
Yeah, good morning. Good to chat to you too.
Yeah, never had you on before, and I've seen a lot of interest actually in the stock on social media, so it's nice to get you on. And you've had some big news out today about an earning agreement at Donovan 2, your copper gold project, and we'll discuss a bit more about that in a bit. But before we do, I know you've got several things going on there, so for people not familiar, just summarise what Alien Metals is all about, if you could, Bill.
Okay, sure. I mean, Alien Metals, obviously listed on AIM in London, a mineral, you know, exploration and development company. So our focus is natural resources, and our focus is probably what we'd like to think of some of the strongest commodities at the moment, essentially copper, silver, iron ore, with smatterings of now, with recent acquisitions, platinum group elements, gold, nickel, etc. And so we have, at the moment, we have a portfolio basically over two jurisdictions, the copper gold project and two silver projects in Mexico, which is a fantastic mining jurisdiction. And then a comparable silver project with associated platinum group elements, and possible gold, nickel type commodities up in the Pilbara of Western Australia, as well as we've got 51% at the moment of two very highly significant iron ore projects, also in the Pilbara region of Western Australia.
Yeah.
So,
So very interesting places, good jurisdictions. And I tell you what, I just saw a note actually from, I think it was Goldman Sachs, saying 2021 is going to be a commodity bull year, which is, you see, well-placed. And let's be honest, commodity prices are starting to strengthen nicely, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you look at silver at the beginning of the year was sort of hovering down 10, 12 US dollars an ounce. Mm-hmm. At the moment, it's sitting more around $24, $25 an ounce. It was slightly higher. But as importantly, it's sort of riding the, has ridden along with the gold, you know, with the strengthening in the gold price. Iron ore is incredibly some of the highest values at the moment, and with predictions of staying strong, especially iron ore coming out of the Pilbara in Western Australia. Because that, you know, that industry and that market is secure and booming compared to some of the other producing nations who have had issues. Obviously, it's, you know, to do with COVID, but also with production and other issues that have reduced their production capacity. Then, you know, as you know, gold is very strong and predicted to stay strong. So copper as well. I mean, with all the new, you know, the new age, the new technologies, all the solar and the UV work, all even especially silver and copper are very important aspects as well. So yeah, we feel we have the right commodities in the right jurisdictions to develop with the right projects.
Yeah, and I just think, you know, next year, once we get these sort of positive news on vaccines coming out, I think sentiment will change. And of course, there's a lot of pent-up demand as far as developments are concerned. So I think we may have a bit of a bull run next year. So it's very interesting. So let's talk about this news today. Earning agreement on Donovan 2 copper gold project and between you and Capstone Mining. Can you explain, take us through what's happening here, please, Bill?
Well, you know, Donovan 2 has always been essentially a copper VMS, volcanic massive sulfide target project. It sits about just over 20 kilometers from the Teck Resources San Nicolas deposit, which is over 100 million tons at just over 1% copper. Geologically, in the right location, from careful sort of constrained exploration phases by Alien over the last 18 to 24 months, including some surface mapping, some sampling of some old wells, water wells that exist on the property, and more recently some ground geophysics work, we came to a point where we were essentially extremely confident that this project hosts some significant copper mineralization, Capstone Mining came along and said they wanted to have a look at the project, which we've been doing over the last few months. The technical teams had a very good, we've been through everything, and we're very happy to announce today that they very much like the project, and they're very keen to drive it forward. They have the funding, obviously. They have the a large technical team with experience in copper projects in Mexico. They have the Cozumel mine in Zacatecas, sort of 30, 35 kilometers away. Same system, same geology. So they're very keen, and we have the earning agreement now signed and moving forward, where they essentially will fund, as the details the announcement has outlined, will fund essentially to pre-feasibility, which give or take will be up to $10 million investment, and at which point there'll be an 80-20 sort of partnership, which is fantastic. And it allows Alien to now obviously focus on our other projects. It means that Donovan 2 will get the just sort of expenditure it deserves, we feel it deserves. But having a partner like Capstone driving that forward, they are extremely keen. The technical guys are very keen to basically get on the ground and get moving, which is great. And it, as I say, it allows us to move, concentrate on other projects, potentially bring in new projects into the portfolio. With having such a great partner sort of working away next to us.
Yeah, absolutely. And so essentially what, you're going to get cash up front over 3 years and then more cash when they go to PEA, is that right?
Well, that's right. I mean, there's sort of cash payments to Alien over a sort of staggered period. And as those, at each phase of work, there's a certain commitment by Capstone, a certain minimum amount of spend, and then at a point up to a 65% sort of earn in, where by that point Capstone would have spent $3.6 million on exploration, and Alien would have received $290,000 sort of as a payment. And then a further cash payment as Capstone, if they decide to move to a PEA, preliminary economic assessment, which is equivalent of a scoping study, and then moving forward, then depending on joint venture agreements for pre-feasibility study funding, which, as you may know, those start incurring quite significant expenses. To get to a final stage of final decision making, so it's sort of over a 3 year period. We're very confident that the project is going to develop really well under a great team, as I said, and with those funds, obviously, Alien are going to be receiving. We can use those for other projects, other exploration, and find new projects to repeat the exercise. If you see what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and looking forward, as far as maybe this and other projects, what some milestones some shareholders or potential shareholders can expect to see coming out?
Well, we have quite recently, as we recently announced, we had some field work completed on the iron ore projects in Western Australia, with over 95 samples taken on the ground over four targets. Extremely encouraged by the initial feedback from the team. They're obviously compiling the report and the summary information. The samples are all in the laboratory in Perth for iron ore and accessory mineral analysis. So hoping that will be very positive news. We're already now looking, and we have in our budgets next phase to do some maiden drilling, so that'll be moving in the next few months. Then we have the two silver projects in Mexico, San Celso and Los Campos. We have the budgets ready for maiden drilling on both of these projects. We're waiting for permitting, so that obviously legally we can go ahead. The drills are ready. Our team in Mexico are ready to go. As I say, we have the funding, so hopefully that'll start as soon as we're able, essentially. The Elizabeth Hill silver project in Australia, we're finalizing the final throes of the trenching program on the actual mining license itself, trenching program to try and identify a repeat mineralization ore body of the existing one. We recently acquired sort of 117 square k's of ground around that project, with numerous actual prospects and targets. Some nickel, some copper, some platinum group elements, a large data set we've acquired as well as part of that deal. So processing that'll bring up some great targets to really start working up. And as I said earlier, we're still looking at other projects. And I think as people see that we are delivering on what we've said we will do. We are looking at, we are being shown more projects, and hopefully we will add to the portfolio at one end, and potentially do another, you know, a similar earn-in agreement with one of our other projects further down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, Bill, every day on the podcast, I highlight the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. So to get on that list, you know, several people have to hit that follow button. So if you could, give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button and add Alien Metals to their watch list, please.
Sure. I suppose if we start on the technical side, you know, we've got, our projects have got excellent mining jurisdictions and, you know, very strong commodities, as we said earlier, you know, copper, silver, iron ore, all very strong, platinum group elements, gold. So we're very much strong commodities, strong mining jurisdictions, with longevity and a good solid future. We feel all our current projects have great potential to that we will add significant value, and they will all rise up the value curve, and the potential for hosting significant mineralization. And I suppose I'd like to say, you know, we've got a strong and excellent technical and corporate team. Our chairman's based in Perth. I'm based here in the UK, having worked across several continents for over 25 years now, scarily, but in the exploration field. So I'd like to think I can use that experience into the pot. We have a great team in Mexico, well-established, well-experienced, who are obviously, so we are able to function in Mexico. And also we have a team in Australia. So at the moment, we're able to function there.
Excellent stuff.
So, yeah, there's probably four, but...
it's a bonus one there, Bill. It's a bonus, Bill. There we are. Cheers. Bill, good to chat to you. And like I say, lots going on. So hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I look forward to it. Thanks very much for your time.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Hill, equity analyst and full-time investor. You all right, fella?
Yeah, morning, Justin. Sorry about last week. I was just ultra busy, so...
When you did that sort of big sort of meeting for Vox here, online video, with chatting to some of the big investors who, you know, quite well known.
Yeah, Capital Markets Summit, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, those guys, I was thinking that they've got a lot of opinion there, because they've got a lot of expertise, a lot of experience there, isn't there? What was your thoughts? If you can sort of sum it up, what was your thoughts as sort of
Yeah, I mean, it's an absolute pleasure to be able to speak to four guys who are just super smart with, like, I mean, the combined experience of those guys between David Buick, Justin Urquhart-Stewart, Martin Gilbert and Chris Whatley is probably around about 150 sort of, like, you know, capital markets years. Mm. So it was absolutely brilliant. And they sort of, like, shared a lot of the anecdotes and experiences they had. And it actually coincided with the 33rd anniversary of the of Black Monday. I don't know whether you remember that one. But,
no, I don't. I was too young, man. I was even born then, Paul.
Well, there you go. I can remember. I was at college and I lost half my term's fees on the stock market in one day. So I was nursing some wounds at the time. But no, big picture wise, what was coming out, and I mean, I'm totally with you. I think we've discussed in such that once this level of sort of immediate uncertainty clears, in that maybe the sort of the US presidential elections, I mean, Brexit is a bit of a non-event. And also once we get a sort of a vaccine or an effective therapeutic, which could be in the next month or certainly in, you know, next 2 months, once that sort of uncertainty clears, I mean, it was a brilliant comment that Chris Watlin made. It's going to be, next year is going to be like putting a lighted match on kerosene, because he just thinks the stock market is going to fire up. And now it isn't going to be everywhere. It's going to be, you'll see a rotation between the sort of like your mega cap tech, which has been hugely boosted this year by COVID, and they've gone up 30%. It's going to be rotated back into sort of like value. So he thinks, along with sort of like, you know, people like Tom Lee at Fundstrap, that they're going to have that, you know, a big improvement in the value side, and that's actually, I'll tell you, some sensible guys and some, you know, where is the serious money going at the moment? Well, is it coincident that ahead of that sort of like clearing of the cloud, there's been a noticeable tick up in M&A? We had this morning a big US private equity real estate fund bought McCarthy and Stone. We had one of the big casinos buying William Hill not long ago. We've also got a trade buyer picking up G4S. I mean, is that all coincidence? I just don't believe so. So,
yeah. You but know. You know what? I think I agree completely with Chris Watlin and Fan Strat there. You know, next year will be quite bullish, I think, for the markets. But now is the time. While there's fear here, now is the time to start taking positions, you know? And like I say, in some of these good brands, good companies have been bombed out, whether it's travel or leisure or hospitality or whatever they are, even banks. But I mean, because if you look at it, infections will sort of drop now because we've had the media fear fest, local lockdowns. So that'll drop. So automatically there won't be that fear that they've been pumping out. Even though, if you look at the reality of the situation, I don't think it's going to be a problem because so we had excess capacity in the NHS. Yes, from wave one. So and this wave, the younger people get infected, they're not being impacted as much. Then you've got, you know, news from at least three or four big pharma companies come out before the end of the year. In fact, before the end of November, I think two are going to be reporting on. So you've got that, the vaccine. We know more about the virus. Testing will become faster and better. You know, therapeutic drugs are getting better, more widely prescribed, like remdesivir, you know, dexamethasone, and antibody therapies as well. So actually, put all that together, you know, and we're going to have a heck of a rally. But now is the time. While the fear is still here, we know there's like the internal here is coming. But once that comes, I think the market will step up, like you say, not all the market, but these value plays, the ones have been beaten down. And so now is the time where there's still a bit of fear around, take positions, because then that movement, that first, like, as we all know, that the fastest bounce, the fastest move is normally the bounce of the bottom when, you know, the fear is lifted. It's like having a seller in a company, isn't it? A big seller, and all of a sudden the seller disappears, and the stock just jumped because it's been oversold for a long time. That kind of thing. So I think now is the time to take positions in companies you really liked, but it's hammered down by this the COVID-19, because I think over the next year or so it's going to start to re-rate, you know.
I hate agreeing with you, Justin, but I can't argue, unfortunately. And with this level of uncertainty, I mean, we had another big hitter on CNBC on Wednesday, I think it was, a guy called Mike Wilson, who's the CIO for Morgan Stanley. And he's on the same page, but he believes they're going to get a 10% correction in the next month or so on extra volatility. And the reason why he cites that is, one, because of the presidential election, they'll just be throwing rocks at one another, but also because he believes that actually we still haven't seen the worst of the peak in infections in the US in terms of COVID. And I know I saw overnight you had that Fauci guy along with Dr. Scott Gottlieb both saying they're on, you know, they're a week, America is a week away of sort of record infections. But we're going to get, I'm with you, we're going to get through that. And again, Chris Watley had a brilliant expression, the stat du jour. And the stat du jour, which Mike Wilson came up with, is $2 trillion of cash just sitting in effectively ETF bond funds, just parked there, waiting to come back into the stock market. Just think, $2 trillion. I mean, that's just like, you know, another size of Apple, of just marginal cash coming, you know, potentially coming in. So I'm with you. When this starts to turn, it could start turn quite rapidly. And so it's, where do you put your money? And the question comes back to you, Jed, Justin, what are you buying?
Well, I'm just, do you know what? Like I said, I've held a couple of companies for a while. I mean, I'm it's almost like now I've got the stage where if you do research on a company, I'm trying to get into that space where if you're researching a company and you like it, rather than looking around for a new shiny thing, just top up in the ones you've got. If you still like it, nothing's changed. And so, you know, things like Polarian, Salt Lake Potash, I own Symphony Environmental, I own Roslyn Data on the market, Gfinity, Escape. And I'm saying, do you know what? I've got enough there. I've got tech, I've got esports, I've got, clean sort of tech. I've got Polarian, which is med tech, on the market, you know, housing. I've got enough there, you know, distributed over different sectors there. So I just think if it dips in those, I'll just rebuy those, some of those, because, you know, I see still a lot to go, and that's the problem.
How many stocks do you hold?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and a fund. But as I say, the thing is, it's always nice to go and find, like, everyone likes a bit of shopping, especially whether it's, in, you know, females, I hate to be sexist, but like my wife likes going shopping out for anything, you know. But I like shopping in the stock market.
You are being sexist there, Justin.
Yeah, I like shopping on the stock market, you know. And it's, everyone sort of does. Everyone likes to find this new shiny thing that could be, you know, transform your portfolio. But essentially, I've got, you know, trying to learn, look within your portfolio. If you're not overexposed on a stock and it dips, look at it. If you still like it, there's still lots to go, just top up, you know? You don't have to keep looking for new shiny things all the time, because you're just diluting your holdings, really. Like I did that spreadsheet, like I said, on a video in the week about how many stocks should you ideally own. And I was saying, if you're owning over 20, unless you've got loads and loads of money, this is. But if you're a normal private investor with, you know, an average sort of size portfolio or funds, and you know having over 20, you may as well just go for a fund, because you're not going to outperform the market unless you're an amazing picker. So I think, you know, 10 for me, between 5 and 10 is ideal for me. That's all I need. You know,
and it all depends on what you sort of, it comes down to time horizons and risk tolerance on that one. Because yes, if you have 10 big cap stocks like Unilever, their beta's going to be low. But if you shove all your money, 5 or 10, into small caps, your beta is going to be, and what I mean by beta, I know it's a technical term, but it's an amount of volatility and what the sort of the size of the drawdown and the likes of the liquidity can be. So I would say your portfolio construction is not dissimilar to mine, because you and I have pretty thick skins and we're prepared to take a lot of pain, and we've been through this before. Yeah. But I would say to newbie investors, then if you are going straight into small caps and you go 5 to 10, the volatility of the overall portfolio, regardless of the sector spread you have, can be really quite tough to be at sort of time. So, you know, it all comes down to timescales, how you actually want to play it in terms of, you know, mix of your portfolio, and I'm sort of 2 to 5 years. But I would say...
And it's, like you say, it's risk tolerance, but also reward tolerance. So that little, I did a little spreadsheet just to show, and I showed a number of holdings, and I said, you imagine if you're all...
Reward tolerance? What's that?
Well, no, what I'm saying is people think they're going to be rich, right? And they hold 10 to 30 stocks. And I think, let's say someone's got a portfolio of, say, 20, 30 grand, right? If you're holding, you know, 20 stocks, you're never going to do that well. You're never going to outperform the market with that money. You've got to actually, you know, concentrate a bit more on a few stocks.
It depends
stocks.
On what level of outperformance. If you look at somebody like Terry Smith, for instance, who's outperformed the market for 2 decades when he's run it, he has a portfolio of about 36, 35, something
that. He's got a heck of a lot of money, hasn't he? No.
But his outperformance, we are talking percentages. So effectively, if the stock market goes at 5%, he's outperformed it, but by 3% consistently, which is significant. Don't get me wrong, I'm not dissing that. But when you hit your numbers to me about 2 weeks ago, I mean, you haven't just done 3%, you've done 20%, 30%, 40%, you've done enormous alpha. And that's because it's the risk upside.
Yeah.
It's basically the beta upside you get to correspond with the beta downside that you may get if you get a drawdown.
Yeah. But I say that, you know, even I said I'm largely, you know, I'm in small caps, micro caps as well. And my audience is pretty much that level. And my audience is private investors, you know, pretty much. I mean, people who listen to the podcast pretty much all listen to my, they hold the same kind of stocks I hold, you know, so that's what I'm talking about. But I also say, anyway, you can still mitigate or reduce the risk on these small cap stocks by doing basic research. Like, one of the biggest risks for small caps or micro cap stocks is cash, you know, liquidity.
Oh, yeah.
And do they have enough cash to get them through to the next value generation point? Like, for example, their break even point. If they don't take a position, because they may rally now, but when they're going to raise some money, it's always difficult to raise money, you know, so wait until they've got that money. So things like that, you know, just, and I've got a 9 sort of filter system I use to reduce the risk and look at what I'm looking for. And, it's all about...
You've got to get the correct matching on you personally, okay?
Yeah.
Is how much research can you do, i.e. how much, you know...
That's another thing. Yeah, that's another thing. Too many stocks, you can't... It's like, if you're working, you know, 9 to 5, for example, and you've got kids, you've got, you know, a wife, and you've got lots of things going on, how can you actually do deep research on 20 or more stocks? You can't. You know, you better offer holding a fund that covers the stocks and then having a dabble at a few other stocks, you know, and actually doing some deep research on a, you know, handful of stocks, you know?
Yeah, that's a barbell strategy, effectively. Yeah. You've got your funds give you the ballast, and then effectively your single stock shooters give you that extra volatility and extra outperformance. I would say, though, coming back to effectively matching your time horizons with your abilities, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, if you are somebody who is genuinely can look through downtimes to 2 to 3 years, even if a small cap has got sort of cash on the balance sheet, etc., then that's great. But it's going to test, when we do go through down, it's going to test your patience. Now, if you're a kind of person who's not that patient, genuinely, and you're trying to kid yourself, you've basically got a 3 to 5 year time horizon, you will tear yourself apart. You'll start doing suboptimal things. So you've got to be honest with yourself. If my time horizon is 3 to 5 years or 2 to 5 years or even 10 years or Buffett is forever, then you've got to be patient. And patience is number one when it comes to trying to outperform yourself. And that's what Buffett does all the time. Yeah. And it's difficult. Don't get me wrong. Even if you've got a great quality company who's got no cash problems and it's trading at half the value you think it is, or even a third of the value you think it is, it can be quite sort of like, you know, demoralizing when you hold it for a year or 2 years, because things stay out of favor for longer than you think.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. No, yeah, but I try and get the best sort of price on any stock I buy. Do you? I mean, I know you don't scale it. I want to be, you know, whether I hold it for, like, you know, like I said, Plarium now, I've held over a year. In fact, almost close to 2 years. But every time I've topped up quite a few times, but every time I top up, it's only because I think I'm getting a good price. And I think, well, it's dipped again now. And when it hits this level, I look at the chart. So, but I want to try and be in profit as soon as I can, don't you?
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. All I would say is that scaling in is good in terms of, you know, dollar cost averaging. But having said that, remember, I mean, in theory, it should happen. The stock market goes up 80% of the time. Now, if that was correct, if you don't get correction, you know, you get the occasional correction, but it goes up most of the time, then scaling in is actually a losing trade. So you have to do it to such that what works for you and scaling in works for you, because it gives you confidence, you learn more, and it gives you, you know, you more reassurance and all that kind of stuff. But I choose to typically choose to do it a different way, because stock markets go up 80% of the time. Well, I mean, they do elsewhere. They don't always do it on the FTSE, because if you look at over 20 years, the FTSE's gone nowhere.
Yeah, never. You know, stock markets go up 80% of the time, but you know, you can pick a stock that doesn't. You know, you can pick a stock that will crash and burn. So
So, I'll tell you one actually, which was quite interesting, that you used to own, and I know we've talked about it here before, but it came up in the Capital Markets Summit, was HSBC. And what was really interesting was a concept that Martin Gilbert said was break up the Asia business and the UK business. That would leave realize a huge amount of value, release it. And what was quite interesting, if you look at some of the, just on the banking sector, because I mean that is the epicenter of COVID. I mean, it's the shares are trading at all-time lows. Even back to the Great Financial Crisis, all of these stocks are just
Do you know what? Doesn't that sit to you? I know you hold lows. Doesn't that worry you a bit? Because I'm thinking this is where the buck stops. You know, with all this issues of businesses going through and all this stuff. At the end of the day, it's the bank that will take them. Obviously, interest rates are low for a long time. And you worry about, you know, because to me, why I got up HSBC and I took it, in fact, I held it for my father, so he won't be impressed, but he's a concept, so he's fine. But I took it out, I thought, it's going to go a lot lower. I don't know how long it'll be like, done here for. And in the end, it came down to, I don't really understand these bigger banks' balance sheets and stocks anyway. And I thought, looking at the chart, it's horrendous. It's never really risen. It's only, even looking back at the old big sell-offs, the last five times it sold off, or the last three times, looking now on the chart, until it goes above, and you never look at this, I know, that 200-day moving average, it's nobody even touching it, because it can keep going, it's like an oil tanker, the momentum for it just grinding lower and lower, it's hard to stop. And you think, let's just wait until it's up in an uptrend now, and then get in, because the downtrend...
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how you buy. If you buy on trends, then great, but I mean, I frankly don't. I look at price and value, what I think the things are worth, and then I'm happy to actually take that risk and buy at a price that's 50% less than what I think it's worth. Then I'm happy to hold for a year, 2 years, 3 years, until that actually happens, and I think that's what's actually going to be happening. I mean, if you look at sort of like JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman Sachs last week, they just knocked the ball out of the park in terms of their results. Barclays today said that their loss impairments, we're just talking provisioning, we're not talking actual losses, we're just talking provisioning. I mean, basically, their second half provisioning for COVID is going to be significantly, I think they used, or materially less than what it was in the first half, and 2021 will be less than 2020. So they see clear water ahead. I could just see these banks the full year results in March, starting dividends again? What's that going to do? You know, and these things trade for destruction. Half of net tangible assets. That's like giving you a pound, Justin, and I'm saying I'm going to buy that quid off you for a 50p. I'll take that trade any day of the park. You know, why not?
Yeah. I know. Listen. I think the banks will have a big rebound. Like I said, you know, looking at it, I'd wait until it's back in an uptrend because you don't know how long it's going to grind out. I mean, we don't know how long the fallout will be, though, for banks. I mean, we can still see we're going to have a technical rally, I think, you know, in the markets after we get some good news. But I think the economy is not only back to sort of super strength or with the way it was pre-COVID for a while, you know. So we'll still have these fallouts from businesses and all that stuff and loans going bad for a long time. Don't you think
possibly. But you just look at, have you ever in your life, because I have and I'm older than you, okay, have you ever seen a recession, particularly a prolonged recession, when you've had a housing market boom? Has there ever been one?
No.
Well, of course there hasn't, because the housing market is just so flipping important to the economy in terms of, you know, home ownership. People use it as their own ATM. They do renovations. That gives them optimism, the house prices. And you spoke to Clive Beattie, didn't you, 2 weeks ago on the market? What did he say about the housing market? Was he saying he's seeing housing prices collapse?
Yeah, no, sir, but the thing is, exactly. It's very busy and a very buoyant time. And the thing is, I got a guy on Twitter, a friend I sort of talk with, and he's not so bullish on the housing market. And
who's that?
I won't mention names, but I was thinking what you said, actually. I said, well, I've never known. Okay, you get little downturns and little, you know, it's times when people don't go buying and all that stuff. But, you know, houses has always been, people want to own houses in this country. You know, they aspire to buy a bigger house. That's the whole thing. It's never, you never see house prices dropping by 10, 20% ever. It never, ever happens. They'll have a dip by 1, 2%. That's it. That's your dip.
It does. You do get occasionally, the 90s, I remember house prices in London.
Hang on, the 90s? That's 30 years ago.
So they do. And that's when you get a recession. What I'm saying is that you don't get a recession when house prices are increasing. They're up 5% at the moment.
Do you know what I see? Like you said, it's an asset. I've thought about this for a while, and people don't often see this in terms of assets and stuff. And there are people out there, you know, and thinking, listen, if you got spare money, where do you put it now? You know, there's no point keeping it in the bank. No point at all. You know, I said, and I spoke to someone actually whose uncle was looking for to buy a bigger house because he had cash in the bank and he didn't like the stock market. He didn't understand that it's too volatile. And so you do get this section where people start buying a house because it's a solid asset, you know, it will never lose that much. Like I said, you have to go back 30 years when this house prices took a big tumble. Generally they don't, do they, you know?
Yeah, and what you've also got is that a shed load of people are coming out of cities and buying big piles.
Exactly,
buying 4, 5, 6-bedroom houses in the shires because it gives them a garden, gives them an extra bit of space. And because they can't actually spend on experiences at the moment, they can't go on holidays, dining out, where are they spending their money? They're doing home improvements, they're buying home furnishings, they're buying houses, they're buying cars. I mean, it's goods, tangible goods, they're just going through the roof. I mean, can you pick up a chest freezer now? I mean, you can't do it because they've all gone. And likewise with bread making machines and coffee making machines, they're all sort of like, you know, got hot off the shelves. It's just because people are thinking, right, okay, I'm going to treat myself and, you know, spend some money. So the same thing with houses. But coming back to full circle, if you believe the housing market, which I do, isn't going to crash, and that's quite a big assumption, but hey, I don't think it's that risky assumption, even though the economists are saying, cool, it's going to go down by 7 or 8% next year. I just don't go and see it. But assuming that doesn't occur, I actually think we're going to have a soft landing next year in terms of the economy. And I can see the stock market absolutely roaring on the back of it. Yeah, and when it comes to sort of positioning, for instance, who's going to do well? It's the people who build 4, 5, 6-bedroom houses, Taylor Woodrow or Wimpy, which I own. And who else is going to do well? Well, it's the mortgage providers like Lloyds. I mean, you know, and what's doubly interesting is everybody says about the banks and this sort of stuff, oh, they can't make any money because of the net interest margin, because of the flat yield curve. Well, just have a look at what's happening about effective interest rates, or effectively when you get a loan, the mortgage rates are increasing. They're decoupling from the treasury yield curve or the gilt yield curve in the gilt curve. And what that means is that they are effectively lending money out to people like me and you who are buying houses at a much higher rate than the government's giving that money to. So they're actually getting a nice margin in between.
Yeah.
Likewise with corporates, because they can't move bank, and so consequently they've just got one stop shop. They've got to take. They're basically price takers when it comes to renewing their loans.
Yeah, I tell you what's quite telling, actually, is every sort of week, if I remember it and I catch up, but I download onto a spreadsheet of the jobless figures in America. You know, I still do that. And
that was quite good the other day.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you know what? I'm going back to a chart, trying to put this picture in your head here. A chart, though, of 21st of March, all right? They continued claims. There's people who are obviously continuing claiming from 2 weeks in a row. So they're at 3 million then, pretty much. Now, over the next 2 months, up to May, they shot up to 24 million from 3 million, right? 24 million continued claims, which was the peak, and that was in the 9th of May. Since then, they've gone down to 10, to May. Now they're down to 8.3 million. So they're down from 24 million down to 8.3. So only 5 million above where they were, and they're still going lower. So to me, they are going back to work, slowly maybe, but they're getting there. Like, they're only 5 million off now where they were before this crisis started. So, and 5 million in America is not a massive amount, you know? So it is getting there, and it'll take a while, but the drop-off has been very quickly, so we can see people going back to work, you know? So that's quite encouraging in my mind. And that, of course, will stimulate the economy, because people are not going back to work, you know, if there's no jobs. So there are jobs there. And like you say, it'll take a while, but I think once we get those vaccines out there, and I know a lot of people saying, well, they're maybe not going to be effective, they're not safe. And I thought, well, do some more research, because, you know, they're looking quite good at the moment. Did you see that independent report on AstraZeneca's saying it's doing exactly what they programmed?
Oh, marvellous. No, I didn't know. Brilliant. Yeah. Okay, it hits both, doesn't it? It hits the antibodies, it stimulates them, and then also hits the T cells, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. So there was independent research on that, and I think Pfizer are quite confident coming out before. Pfizer reckon, you know, they're going to have be mid-November. They said it was going to be end of October. Mid-November now, a readout on phase three, and hopefully they're going to get past within a couple of weeks, and they have 100 million doses ready to go. I think Britain's bought 40 million of those. So,
what's that going to do to consumer and business confidence?
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of rocky, isn't it?
Exactly.
I mean, people are just going to go, you know, think, fantastic, you know, let's have a good Christmas. Why not?
spend,
because we can see the light at the end of the tunnel.
I think Santa rally is going to be massive this year.
He won't be landing, he'll be going to the moon, won't he?
Yeah, I know.
In his sleigh. I tell you, this is an interesting one, and this is why the podcasts are so good, you know, in terms of you get a bit of crowd involvement and stuff. Can anybody out there explain to me why GSK, which is the world's biggest vaccine maker, it does shingles and all kinds of different products, but it's the world's biggest and got the most experts in vaccines, and also it's got the biggest franchise in respiratory disease. Why is it its shares trading at like 4 or 5 years lows? So somebody can explain. It's trading at half the price.
I asked Chris Bailey this yesterday. Yeah, because I had a chart alert just come up on GSK. It's basically hit an RSI, a relative strength index of 30, which is oversold, which means it's a weak price at the moment. I thought, why is that down there? And I don't understand because...
Particularly when it's in the hot areas.
Yeah, yeah.
So if anybody out there has got a good read on GSK... Let me know, because I mean I know there's question marks over the management team there, but frankly, I mean, it looks like a no-brainer to me. They say that they're right into the sort of the vaccine area, so for future pandemics, and they're right into respiratory diseases. I mean, they may have missed on the actual COVID vaccine, but very few people will actually make money on the actual COVID vaccine. Yeah. But going forward, you know, they could be doing, because there'll be so much investment going in, they could do really, really well. But
this is £13.50, right? This is where it dipped to on the dash for cash, the March sell-off, you know, and it bounced back up to like 17 quid, and that's back down at that level now. And we're only talking like 13 quid when we're back in the... In fact, it's quite. If you look at GSK's shares, it does do those big dips and then go. I don't know why. It just comes down. Like 2018, it went down to that level, 12, 80, 13 quid.
That was because Neil Woodford sold out of his position. It was a wrong strategy.
Yeah.
But I mean, the thing is such that, you know, if you've got spare cash on the sidelines and you want to put it in, then you can either go single shot into sort of like small caps, or if you're a bit sort of like, you know, not as quite as risk tolerant and you're sort of a bit more cautious, why not go into one of the biggest FTSE companies around, GSK, stick some money into there, and as long as you are genuinely 4 or 5 year sort of time horizon. I can't see you losing that much money on GSK. If I was going to say anything, in 5 years' time, the chances of it could well have doubled by now, given what we've just been through.
Well, I just consider it. I don't know what they call it. I thought, I've got a bit of cash. Maybe I'll just chuck it in there for a while, see what happens. And if I need it, it's liquid, so I can sell it. It's fine. You know, it's not a problem.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you would. I mean, I say there might be something I'm missing. I mean, I haven't really deep dived into exact. I know there's a risk of them also spending a lot of money trying to beef up their cancer franchise, because they sold it originally about 4 or 5 years ago, and then they want to get back into cancer. That was a strategic whoops, I made a mistake there type of strategy.
Well, Chris Bennie did say one thing, that is that the lady who came on board, she came
Emma Walmsley,
she came on with a bit of trumpets blaring and a bit of a hoopla, and she's gone into sort of the more sort of commercial side, didn't they, the retail sort of stuff, and it hasn't
she's
been
over the counter stuff,
which sometimes the margins haven't been as good, so she sort of, he said he thinks she hasn't lived up to that sort of noise and
I've heard that as well. I think he's probably right, but these kind of companies, if the management team don't work, then the shareholders get rid of them. The chairman will tap on the shoulder and say, look, time to move on, you know.
And one thing, I don't know about this, but I assume they're one of the big dividend payers. They're still paying their dividend.
Last time I looked, they were sort of like 80p. Okay. I mean, I know they've got, I think their net debt to EBITDA is probably bumping up to 3x, but they can afford that because essentially they've got very, very reliable income streams.
Yesterday, literally, it pinged up on my chart thing app there, and I even looked down their news line and thought, what's the problem here? Just saw no news release apart from a holdings in company. Hang on, someone's selling them. The capital group companies went from 5% to 4.9%. But I thought, well, what's going on here? And I couldn't say anything. Positive opinion on the HIV thing, and I thought, well, there's nothing there that's worth.
The only thing I could think of is such that obviously it's sort of like dirted its own water, so to speak, in terms of, you know, doing this cancer. Are we in cancer? Are we not in cancer? But there could be something. There could be something under the water in terms of, you know, you occasionally get these huge sort of litigation that one of the drugs hasn't worked, or they've got sort of like the DOJ's having a go about something or other. I mean, I can't believe that there is, but hey, because people would have sort of like talked about it. But there may be something under the tyres. I don't know. We'll wait and see. But
generally got a long time horizon. I think do a bit of search for that. I think, but this is a good place to park some money.
Big gap. Well, one small cap that was worth a bit of news last week was getting a chance was actually Equals. Yeah. They made a lovely little bolt-on acquisition, Effective FX. I mean, I own the stock, but I mean, they bought it for like just over 3.2x EBITDA, 1.8x sales. It's just going to be a straight lift and shift. All the fixed costs are going to go because they're just going to bolt it into their B2B business, make 60-70% gross margins. I mean, it was perfect. But the important bit, given that it's only a small little business, the important bit, it just shows you how easy this is to do. Once they've built their banking grade technology, if you've got small little B2B Forex or international payments operators like Effective FX, you don't take any of the cost. You just take the straight revenue and it just goes straight down to the bottom line. I mean, the synergies are just massive and you're buying it at almost like distress level. So, I mean, I just tip my hat to, Ian Stafford on that one, Taylor, because, I mean, that is just perfect. But it just shows you that is a really beautiful model, because they could just go on, hoover up a shed load of small little players and essentially, you know, just drive the bottom line through M&A, because, you know, it's instantly, I mean, you know, it's not just a little bit earnings accretive, it's hugely value accretive and then massively earnings accretive. So, you know, I thought that was really, it just basically rubber stamped why I think the business model is doing really well. And the other thing was which I thought was really good news for Equals. I mean, I just disclosed that I own, you know, some reasonable shares in this in the company. But I mean, the other thing I thought was really good, the biggest shareholder, Crystal Amber, has just increased its stake to 25%. And these guys are really super shrewd. They obviously know the business inside out. They've been around for some time. They've probably got a hot seat into the board. For them to hoover up that much, I mean, I could see this you know, they're going to hold the board's feet to the fire, but that's probably a good thing, and therefore they're going to have the discipline as well as the growth. So I think if anybody wants to take a bit of a sort of like a more speculative type of share compared to GSK, a small cap, then that's this is just trading at ultra low levels, and you could see this go on fire next year. And I wouldn't be surprised if somebody wanted to buy this, and let's be clear about it, there's lots and lots of consolidation going off in the fintech e-payment space, which is where these guys are. If anybody wants to come along, hey, just name your price to Crystal Amber, and if they two parties agree, it's going at that price, isn't it? So, you know, it's got some interesting M&A opportunities and it's to buy. It's got it could be a consolidation play, but if it isn't, organically it should really sort of like, you know, on a pivot point, it should really be at an inflection point for next year. So I'm positive, particularly if people start going on holiday. I mean, Jesus, or we get, you know, I'm positive on it, and I think it's a very interesting one for people to put the slider all over.
Yeah. No, I think Equal is definitely one of these companies that will rally strongly. You know, over the next month or so, because of just generally the lifting of the fear, which is a bit of a fake media fest of fears created by the media. I understand why they're doing it, try and get the infection rates down. But I think this will lift, and then we'll get more positive news over the next couple of months, and I think sentiment will change. Marvellous stuff. Paul, thanks for that, fella, and we'll speak to you next week.
Yeah, cheers, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You're right, Russ?
Yeah, very well, in good health, I'm pleased to say. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Do you know what I did? Every sort of Thursday, Friday, I download the Fed figures for the jobless, and it's looking not too bad. I mean, I'm looking at a chart here, so you've got initial claims and continued claims. And initial claims, of course, were massive, but continued claims went up to 24 million on May. When is it? May the 5th or something like that, 9th. And the 24 million continued. Right now, down at 8 million. So literally a third of what it was. So it's going in the right direction, isn't it? American markets and all that stuff. I know you've been looking at transport and planes and all this stuff. Is that being reflected? What's it looking like on that side of the?
It is. It doesn't mean I'm a train spotter, by the way. a vicious allegation. But I do like looking at transport stocks, planes, trains, trucks, ships. And because of, you know, you've got Richard Russell's Dow theory that if the Dow Transport Index is doing well, then the Dow Industrials Index will be doing well, because the theory is if goods are sold, then inventory has to be moved around and shelves replenished. It's fairly straightforward. And so the good news is that in the calendar year, the Dow Transport is actually up 8%. The Dow Industrials is basically flat. And over the last 12 months, the Dow Transport is up 12% and the Dow Industrials is up 5 or 6. So you're actually getting, from a market perspective, what you want to see, which is the transports leading. And the transports index is actually pretty close to an all-time high, just near 12,000. So, and that's 20 stocks, and it's things like FedEx, it's airlines, and obviously the airlines have not been good, but things like freight and shipping stocks and logistics players have actually been performing very well, which you take to be quite encouraging. And you've actually got one or two companies in the US that are quoted saying that, you know, you try getting a container ship right now, it's really hard. You know, trucking capacity is tight, shipping capacity is tight. Now, the counter argument to this is, and I guess also to your stats on US employment, is that, well, look, lots of people in the US got those much needed payment protection checks that were $1,200. They've now gone down to $600. What happens when they wheedle away? Is the economy just basically getting by on the fumes of previous stimulus programs, which are about to expire, which is why there's the huge debate over what the next US stimulus program is going to be. So it might be that the foundations are fragile, but equally, I can't see any incoming president just deciding to let everything roll over. But nevertheless, at the moment at least, you know, so the transport index is doing what it does, what you'd like to see it doing. You've actually got an American index called the Cass Freight Index that looks at containers. Now, it has fallen year on year for 22 months in a row. So you would think that actually the US economy probably wasn't in a brilliant position before the pandemic, but it is now down only 1.8% year on year, and has been improving consistently. And if you're a rail spod like I am, you can even have a look at the Port of Long Beach's website and the Port of Los Angeles and Port of Oakland's websites, and they will tell you how many containers are going in for export, import, how many are empty, and the trends there are pretty good. Long Beach, which is America's second biggest port after LA, loaded container volumes have grown 3 times in 4 months. So you are starting to get some sense of the economy, you know, clicking back into gear, and the transport stocks are telling us that. So all I can say is, you know, long may that continue. But equally, if you did see the Dow Transport Index roll over, then, you know, attention, I think, should be paid. But at the moment, at least, it's going in the right direction. Yeah. And, you know, the Danish company, A.P. Møller - Mærsk, is the world's biggest container shipping company. Yeah. They've just raised earnings guidance for the year. So, again, and if you draw the, I know you're a chart wonk and I'm not, but if you look at A.P. Møller's share price against the FTSE All World over a long period of time, it's not bad. I'm not saying it's perfect, but if the shipping company's steaming along, generally speaking, the All World's looking pretty pleased with itself and vice versa.
Yeah, do you know what my question is here? Is that at the moment we've largely become an online, you know, existence now, haven't we? We're all existing online, and a lot of the shopping we do is online, which obviously needs shipping. And I thought, you know, and so it's odd the change from. How do we know the difference? If it's changed, the mix has changed from people going to shops or, you know, generic industrials to normal consumer stuff from home. Because literally, we are now hardwired into Amazon pretty much. Our Christmas presents come via Amazon or, you know, all online sites. So would that affect, you know, also the people sitting at home just doing nothing?
I think it could do. You know? Yeah, I think it, and I think there are other cross currents. My lovely lady wife works for a lifestyle retail brand, which will not be named because you're not here to advertise. But they are, interestingly, they've got lots of cross currents. They're actually seeing people shop early for Christmas.
Yeah.
Because people either don't want to queue or they think they might not be allowed to queue if there's a local lockdown.
Yeah.
So they are buying online. This company addresses, I will say, a quite well-heeled affluent demographic, so it's in a sweet spot anyway. But nevertheless, they are seeing their customers ship in kit early. So this retailer is looking to get in extra stock, which, again, passenger planes aren't as common as they were, and that's a big knock to air cargo capacity. Container shipping, we've just discussed, is pretty tight already, and this is making it tighter still. And this brand is also looking to bring in orders, shipments pre-Brexit, so that if there isn't a deal and the tariffs kick in under WTO on the 1st of January, their prices don't go up or their costs don't go up by 12%. Which is what you're staring at right now. So I think you are seeing there is the possibility, you're dead right, that the transport stocks are getting a bit of a benefit from lockdown and changes in consumer buying patterns. Are they going to be permanent or not? We will see. And again, that's why I think if you saw the transports roll over, you'd think, ooh, that's a little bit of a bad sign. But at the moment, at least, deceptively, FedEx and UPS are having an absolute ball at the minute, you know, which, again, would point to, I think, some structural but potentially some cyclical at the same time.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I was doing the wife went to pick up the kids from school yesterday, and we stopped at traffic lights, and over the way there, because it's sort of an industrial estate, and this massive new warehouse just popped up, seemingly, and DHL was on it. I thought, wow, I didn't even know that was there. So these things are probably popping up all around the country, aren't they, these distribution outlets for logistics, you know, and it's amazing.
And you're seeing that filter, you know, Segro, the real estate investment trust that's a FTSE 100 company now, used to be known as Slough Estates, and now it's the much sexier Segro. But that's basically called it and done a brilliant job of building its portfolio of logistics and warehousing assets in the M4 corridor, starting around the Heathrow. I think it even trades at a premium to net asset value, share price-wise, which, when you look at the discount to net asset value that the sort of city office and retail exposed REITs like British Land and Land Securities are trading at, shows you, you know, where investors think there's hot assets to be had and where it's less interesting. And Land Securities this week was so much trying to sell its retail assets, which I think will be interesting because they'll be intrigued to know who the buyers are.
Exactly. Well, the thing is, I'm just thinking right now, if you are, you know, into a retail outfit, a company, and you don't have an online presence, you shouldn't be existing in this day and age, really. But if you are, if you do have an online existence, it's got to be really good now, isn't it? Because, I mean, you've got to compete with the Amazons of the world. And like I said, there are people, I don't know who it was in the week, encouraging people to stop shopping early, digital Christmas kind of thing, because there may be, you know, so many people ordering online, it may take a lot longer than normal. So you've got to be really hot in digital space.
And it's interesting that NEC still argue that physical stores have a role to play as
for how
literally
long?
Shop window. Well, they argue for a while because it literally is a shop window for your brand and your product.
Yeah.
But also as a click and collect destination. But, you know, again, it's intriguing. As more and more people just get the stuff shipped home, and, you know, given that more and more people are going to be working from home for longer, even that, and next big, one of next big click and collect sites in Brighton has closed. It's next to a, it was next to a Marks and Spencers and a little industrial estate just north, just west of where we are. And I drove to get the kids some pizzas from M&S for their lunch today, and the next click and collect store had closed down.
Yeah, well, the funny thing was, my wife yesterday, when I pointed out this DHL, you know, warehouse, massive thing, she said, oh, that'll be handy for picking up stuff, you know, for Christmas. And I thought, well, why don't retailers just use, you know, the logistics that are there, the existing sort of framework and infrastructure from DHL and all that stuff, because if they can't pick it up, they'll just pop to the local warehouse.
Yeah,
and
they're I guess so.
Ever more present, aren't they? So they're not, they don't travel far.
And they, I also saw Royal Mail said that they're actually going to start collecting packages from your doorstep, aren't they?
Yeah, 75 pence, apparently, plus postage. So they, apparently, it's in line with others, other sort of offerings as well. So they are just competing, you know, but... It's a changing landscape, isn't it? But very interesting. Yeah, I always look at it. So one final thing on the industrials. Has this been a precursor generally to? Because I just genuinely think 2021, with vaccines coming online and all that stuff, I think it's going to be a bit of a bumper year for quite a few for the market. Anyway, but is the transport ox? Is that a precursor to a rally?
Normally, if the transports are going up, the industrials follow, and vice versa. So yeah. it's definitely the sort of thing that you'd be looking for as a potential good sign. And I do have a sneaky. I mean, it's interesting that some of the sort of growthy Momo high multiple stocks, and we all know what they are, tech and so on. They are finding it a little bit harder to make ground right now. I mean, Netflix took a drumming this week.
Yeah.
Tesla didn't really go up very much, even though it beat numbers quite comprehensively, albeit again more because of its credit selling rather than its car selling, although the volumes, what they're doing there are still quite amazing. But those stocks, again, seem to be fine. I mean, Netflix, you're the chartist. Have a look at the chart. It's tried to beat $550 four times.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And it's folded up again. It's gone back below 500. There are some of these valuey cyclical stocks. The oil's having people seem to be having a bit of an oily nibble, and some of the deep cyclicals are just trying to make a bit of a fist of it. Now, they tried this a year ago and it didn't last for very long. But if you do get more stimulus, and I suspect you will, I think, and then you actually do get a bit of a normal recovery anyway, as hopefully the virus gets back in his box for whatever reason. I think you could end up with a stronger recovery than people think. Because sentiment is pretty negative right now.
Yes, that's it. I think the balance is about exactly. When you go from that kind of, like, at the moment, I think we are, you know, the media is full of fear, full of these lockdowns. But I think where do you go from this? You can't really ramp up any further. We are at the height of fear. We're not going to do a national lockdown probably. So I think we are at the height of fear here now. And I think we are going to get three or four companies. Big pharma companies releasing news on phase 3 trials, and the indications are they're looking quite positive. So I think this is light at the end of the tunnel, I think, and people just want to something positive, you know. So I think I'm thinking now, maybe look at the companies that are battered down, the TUIs, you know, the Carnival Cruises, and just thinking, maybe is it too early to take a position? I don't know, but I can't see any more bad news.
I guess you're going to have to be brave. I mean, there are companies out there that I'm looking at, like Greggs, Fuller Smith and Turner, companies that have got good brands, good products. We know they were popular before, you know, the pandemic, and I'm sure they'll be popular again afterwards. And, you know, Greggs has got online going, it's got click and collect going, it's got a relationship with Just Eat Takeaway, I think. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the sort of company that you could see. Again, I mean, the shares are at a 2-year low. I can't believe that people are going to stop eating, you know, sausage rolls and sandwiches and ambient temperature snacks forever. So those are the sort of companies that you could see coming back really pretty quickly if and when, you know, people just feel a little bit more confident about the world. And I think they're the sort of things that I would definitely be doing my research on. Now, check out the balance sheet, check out the leases if you're looking at things like retailers, because they are going to be a cash out for them. Just see how much cash they've got, see how long they can last for. And if it's a year or two, they probably are. But you're going to have to accept the fact that the good news in the short term, you know, you've seen GFK, UK Consumer Confidence roll over today. The PMIs have rolled over a little bit. You know, it is going to be choppy going into Christmas for sure, because you've got the local lockdowns, and they are going to make some of the national numbers look pretty poor.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what? It's interesting. I saw Sky News and tweet out coronavirus not among the 10 most common causes of death in September. And also, just on Twitter there, if you're at Greggs, right, they're very good. I mean, if you look at their Twitter account, it's very clever. They did, they posted, as I assume, it's like a turkey cranberry steak bake with a bite taken out of it, looking very nice, saying 2 weeks. That's it.
Oh,
So 2 years ago, they're selling that. That'll drag people back to their shops. There we are.
You would hope so.
Marvellous stuff for us. Speak next week.
Keep well.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. GlaxoSmithKline. Yeah, do you know what? I've talked to Chris Bailey about this yesterday, why it's fallen so much, and we also mentioned it with Paul today. But it's bouncing a little day, up 1.3% to 1350. At 4, Shanda Gold, down 3.25% to 17.13. At 3, 4D Pharma, 130, 13%. At 2, Ferro Alloy Resources, but well followed that company of late. Down 2.7% to 10.7 pence. And at 1, again, Vela Technologies, followed yesterday, one of the top ones followed yesterday. And that's, 5.7% to 0.0925. All right, top five most liked RNSs. It's quite quiet today, actually, on the old RNS front. But at 5, Remote Monitored Systems, Braveheart update on P2F. Evgen Pharma, all approvals received for STAR trial to commence. At 3, Eugene Health, CQC accreditation. At 2, Braveheart Investment, update on Farm Two Farms COVID-19 mask project. And at 1, KEFI Gold and Copper Q3 2020 operational update. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.